Hello, welcome to Activation Energy, a podcast where we discuss health, medicine, and social justice. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Rachel, and we're your hosts today. Thank you for tuning in. I'm talking today with Dr. Molly McNulty. Could you introduce yourself for us?
Sure. I am an attorney, and I graduated from New York University Law School in 1988. I am an assistant professor of public health law and policy at the University of Rochester in the college, which is the undergraduate part of the U of R. I specialize in maternal child health and adolescent health policy, and I also teach advocacy skills. Some of the other courses I teach relate to healthcare and the law, public health law, and maternal and child health. I'm a Rochester native. I left for many years, but came back after I had children. And I'm not your typical academic. I have been involved in public health policy and advocacy for almost 30 years, but it's only in the last 2 years that I've really found a home in academia. I've also worked in nonprofit advocacy groups in Washington, D.C. I've worked for local government. I've worked at the medical center, and I've worked in the corporate sector.
Wow, sounds like you have very diverse experiences. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I guess I just wanted to ask first about your teaching, sort of. You mentioned that you teach quite a few courses here at the U of R. Is there some sort of underlying theme or idea that you structure your classes around?
Yeah, all my courses are structured around the theme of achieving health and social justice through argument, persuasion, and artful communication rooted in the law.
That seems to be also like what your work has sort of focused on. So how would you say that being an attorney and working in other sectors besides academia has informed your teaching?
Well, law school trains attorneys how to use laws to achieve justice. And in a variety of settings, I have used law to work towards specific public health goals and objectives. And here at the U of R, I teach students how to use those legal tools, which include legislation, regulation, and court cases, to advocate for better health outcomes for people, particularly people on the margins of society.
So what would you say is one thing that you've learned through the process of teaching?
I've been surprised at how much students know and how much they bring into the classroom in terms of life experience. Law school is very much a one-way teaching experience where the professor stands up and lectures, students take notes. There's a little discussion, but not much. And in contrast, I have found the undergrads here to be a much richer source of dialogue and inspiration than law school students.
That's interesting. You mentioned that students bring their own life experiences into the classroom. So in a broader sense, people talk about how those life experiences affect people's experiences with healthcare. And people say that all policy is health policy. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Absolutely agree. There is a concept in public health called the social determinants of health, which means that all public policies and laws affect health. And this is premised upon the fact that the leading causes of death in American society today are not infectious diseases, but rather chronic diseases and trauma, both of which are greatly influenced by law and policy that regulate environmental factors, social factors, economic factors. There's another framework called Health in All Policies, which encapsulates this approach and requires governments to, if they adopt this framework, to look at the health consequences of policies that they enact. For example, if they enact a certificate of occupancy law regarding rental housing, they ought to put in an inspection requirement for the presence of lead paint, because that will affect the health of young children. So the city of Rochester has done that. Not every city or county or state has done the health in all policies approach.
Oh, that's interesting. Could you talk a bit more about, like, how wide the adoption?
Well, I think it was grounded in this growing realization about social determinants of health. And partly that was driven by doctors who were frustrated at treating conditions that could have been prevented if there was adequate food or adequate housing, better educational opportunities. And so there has been pressure, not just within medicine and not just within public health, but within the public policy world, to take a closer look at policies that drive these so-called upstream problems.
That's very interesting. Would you say that lack of housing and education, or inequity in general, is like the most important health issue currently?
I think the most pressing health policy issue of our times is the increase in human suffering caused by the increasing wealth inequities in American society. And that's accompanied by growing disparities in racial health, gender health, and other disparities of marginalized communities. Accompanying this increase in human suffering has been a trend toward underfunding public health and education programs. And over the last 20 years, many studies have documented how decimated the public health workforce has been by public program cuts.
Interesting. I guess this is purely speculative, but in your opinion, what might be contributing to, like, increasing or more underfunding of public health?
I think a couple of factors. One is the increase in political polarization since 9/11 in the last 20 years, which means that it's been more difficult to reach compromises on issues of fundamental importance, like maintaining a public health infrastructure. Another factor, I think, is the failure of the public health community to define what is public health. How is it different from medicine? What is the value added? And so I think public health as a field needs to do a better job persuading policymakers that it's worth investing in. Fortunately or unfortunately, the COVID pandemic has made crystal clear what happens when we don't invest in basic things like personal protective equipment and surveillance technology for staff. And the COVID pandemic has brought so many of the underlying disparities to light, from everything from access to medical treatment to the digital divide in education between students who have internet access and those who don't. There are many other COVID-related ways that these inequities have come to light.
That makes a lot of sense. You mentioned that you think one of the issues is that not a lot of people know what public health really is and how it's different from medicine. Do you think COVID has, in that sense, like, inadvertently had maybe a positive impact on how much attention public health receives, or how?
Yes, I do. Although not necessarily in a positive way. For example, many people did not know that public health emergency powers rested primarily at the state level, not the federal level, and in the executive branch, not in the legislative or judicial branches, which means that the governor of the states has a lot of power to issue emergency public health orders. A lot of people object to those orders, and became aware that, A, the government had power, and B, that the governor had power. So I think that COVID has raised the awareness of public health, the importance of public health.
You mentioned that your academic interests lie mostly in health insurance policies and maternal mortality. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, a couple of aspects of that policy work I can mention. One is the expansion of the national public health insurance program called Medicaid, not to be confused with Medicare, which is the universal health insurance program for people, for senior citizens. In New York State, they have been attempting to redesign the Medicaid program, and one of the initiatives is called the First 1,000 Days on Medicaid. And this initiative recognized that a child's first 3 years of life are the most crucial to their development. And so the Medicaid initiative aims to improve the physical, social, and emotional needs of children and their families. This was a reorienting of what Medicaid would pay for in terms of medical care, a broadening of that definition of medical care. And a work group identified 10 new directions for Medicaid for children. And the initiative started in 2019. They completed their recommendations at the end of 2019. And then in 2020, the pandemic came in March. So very little has been done since then. Although I did recently see an announcement in the last couple of months that their state Medicaid program's moving forward with a pilot program to try and integrate some of the community level services like home visiting by peers. So that's an issue I've been tracking, not just in New York State, but countrywide. The second issue I'm focused on at the moment is maternal mortality, and looking specifically at how Medicaid can help reduce maternal mortality. It's a big issue in this country because there's a huge racial disparity between white and black women. The other scandal is that so much of the mortality is preventable if medical care were adequate and delivered earlier. So I'm currently involved in drafting a policy position paper for the American Public Health Association called Expanding Medicaid Eligibility, Benefits, Provider Participation, and Reimbursement for Mothers 1 Year Postpartum. Postpartum means after the birth. This relates to the Medicaid expansion work I'm focused on, but it has a few more details that focus specifically on extending the 60-day postpartum period to 12 months of coverage post-birth, because this is when many life-threatening conditions develop, including postpartum depression.
How would you say, there are obviously a lot of very powerful stakeholders involved in this issue, so how do you go about working to change health policies when insurance companies and other like government agencies might be opposing that change?
This is a really tough issue. The insurance companies in particular, along with pharmaceutical companies, are hugely powerful on Capitol Hill. For example, a recent analysis showed that insurance companies are the top contributors to elected officials' campaigns. In another example, a news article outlined the ways that insurance companies have blocked implementation of a bipartisan piece of legislation. This is legislation that actually was passed and signed by the president that required insurance companies to publicly post their charges for specific procedures on public websites so the consumers know what they're paying for and what they're buying. The analysis found that not only do different hospitals charge different fees for the same procedures, such as heart bypass surgeries, but that the charges varied by the type of insurance plan that consumers have, and that a lot of times the insurance companies are just refusing to comply with the law. One of the effective tools to counter powerful stakeholders has been to garner bipartisan support. But this is really difficult in these partisan-charged policy debates when Democrats and Republicans can't seem to find anything at all to agree on. Another effective tool has been to mobilize public opposition, especially through coalitions of groups that have a common aim. And finally, to use the media to bring attention to sneaky tactics that the powerful stakeholders might be using. And if you're able to do that and generate some collective moral outrage among the public, that can sometimes move agendas through. For example, the Children's Defense Fund, where I used to work in Washington, D.C., was able to defeat many powerful stakeholders, including state governments, by shaming companies into, refusing to pay for children's lives. And we were able to get a lot of controversial legislation through Congress that way, such as expanding Medicaid coverage.
What you said about controversy being kind of a tool for advocating for policy changes was very interesting. Could you talk a bit more about what you think makes for effective health policy advocacy in general?
Sure. Effective policy advocacy combines scientific evidence about policy impact and democratic evidence about popular, political, and media support. So on the one hand, it combines things like evidence-based policy evaluation, which scientists love because they can apply scientific method and show something works. The problem from a public health perspective with evidence-based approaches is that a lot of times public health programs are innovating and they're thinking up brand new programs that never been tried anywhere else, so there's no evidence base for it, other than maybe community demand for those services. Another problem scientists have with evidence is that it often takes into account what people vote for, what the media covers, what politicians want. And my personal philosophy is that that is appropriate in a democracy. So, for example, if a community wants a drug education program by police in their schools, that's okay, even though all the evidence shows it doesn't work. None of the evaluations have shown that it works to decrease drug use. But parents want it, schools want it, so it's been going on for decades. Some examples of advocacy efforts I've been involved in. One example is the United States Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. And this funding pays for blood test screening of children from birth through age 2. Over the years and decades that I've worked on this program, science has changed, and it shows that screenings need to be done at a younger age than age 2. And they need to test for a lower level of exposure. So what originally thought was a safe level of exposure to lead has since been lowered. So that's an important change. Another change affecting the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program is the political environment. 30 years ago, when the program started, the term environmental justice was barely used. But now, we understand that lower-income children live in dilapidated housing and that their exposure to lead poisoning dramatically affects their school performance. And school performance affects later involvement with the juvenile justice system, the inability to get a good job, to go to college. So there's a long-term trajectory as a result of exposure to childhood lead poisoning. And collecting all this information and presenting it to policymakers makes a really powerful case for expanding funding for the program.
Wow, I did not think about cascading effects on that long term of a scale. Thank you so much for talking about that, and you've definitely given me a lot to think about. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for joining us today. For more like this, please subscribe, and you can find us on Instagram and Twitter.